Apple FBI. Survey says you all think it's basically a toss-up who's right. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 22nd of February. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. We've come to that point in the now nearly week-old standoff between Apple and the FBI, where the respective lines drawn in the sand by the two organizations, and more specifically their leaders, seem, with an emphasis on seem here, to be blurring just a bit. This weekend, FBI Director James Comey wrote an open letter saying, and this is pretty much a quote, he just hopes everybody can take a deep breath here. Apple CEO Tim Cook posted a Q&A this morning in which he called for a national commission to study the intertwined issues of policy, technology, and privacy. So we are going to take that glimpse of detente and run with it. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kai.
So listen, I know this is radio, but I want to do a little Venn diagram thing here. I want you to find for me the overlap in the interests of the government and Apple, because that's sort of what these statements that these two men are putting out kind of sound like.
I have some interesting news.
All right, go.
The overlap,
yes,
is security.
Really?
Yes. Ironically enough, this is the part where the two interests overlap here. You might remember that for a long time, government offices used BlackBerries, Kai.
Yes,
you remember
yes.
way back in the
yep.
day? Well, they started transitioning several years ago in 2012 to, guess,
iPhones.
Yeah. So the reason for that was that iPhones have strong encryption and security built into them. And the funny part about this whole debate, in a way, is that both parties here, Apple on the one side and the FBI and DOJ on the other, are all really pro-security when it comes to personal data. And for both, Kai, there are, of course, caveats.
Well, break those out for me, right? I mean, so what is James Comey and the Department of Justice thinking about when they're talking about this idea of security?
So they want things to be secure because you got to remember the government has a lot of people using American-made technology products abroad, right? Hardware and software. Hmm. And there are democratic movements abroad that rely on that technology as well. And the government supports that, right? The government has actually built these kinds of tools in the past itself, and the tech world has started to use them. But, of course, the government in certain situations
right.
wants access to this stuff, and that's their side of it.
All right. Give me the Apple side of it then, because the government, as you know, has said publicly and repeatedly this is a business decision by Apple. So what does Apple have in the security point of view?
Well, I think it's fair to say that they're probably is some truth to that, Kai, right? The United States is Apple's biggest market for iPhones. The second biggest market, China.
Yeah.
So a lot of people agree with Apple's argument here that it's a slippery slope. But at the same time, a lot of people don't. You have this National Pew Research survey yeah. that came out over the weekend saying 51% of people back Apple unlocking the phone and only 38% support not unlocking the phone. So I think that there's a real publicity battle happening here.
Well, so take it to the next step then, because Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, came out today, as I said in the introduction, and offered this idea of a national commission to reconcile security policy, tech policy, and privacy. Where does this go?
I think we're getting closer to the commission solution, Kai. As you said, you know, Tim Cook and Apple seem to support this idea. Kai, most of the people I talk to in the security space say that a tech solution to this larger encryption debate is going to be so much harder to build than a policy solution. But here's something that I think we should remember. A corporation, which generally speaking has unprecedented access to our data, is telling us to watch out for a government that wants unprecedented access to our data. So it'll be really interesting to see how all of this plays out going forward. And it could come from policymakers in Congress in getting these two sides to the table.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. This story, I'm sure, Ben, we will revisit repeatedly in the next weeks and months. See ya. Thanks.
See ya, Kai.
A Michigan man was charged with 6 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempted murder today after those shootings up in Kalamazoo, Michigan this weekend. The man, Jason Dalton is his name, was, as you've likely heard by now, an Uber driver and appeared to have picked up riders before and after the shootings. Police say the company is cooperating fully with the investigation. The company is defending its screening process for its drivers. But Uber's still in a tough spot, right? Seeing as how its business model is basically based on convincing people to get into a stranger's car. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at where things might go for Uber from here.
There are two words in most headlines about these shootings. Uber driver. Scott Galloway is a marketing professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. He says the steps Uber needs to take are clear.
Three things you have to do. Everybody knows those three things, and they're hard to do.
First, acknowledge what happened. Second, make sure it's the top person, the CEO, who publicly addresses these issues.
And the third is you have to overcorrect. They have to announce immediately a series of additional screening tools that they're implementing.
This incident is already prompting questions about how Uber screens its drivers. It'll also likely reignite the debate about how they're regulated, says Christopher Koopman. He's a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
So people will most likely look at this and say, well, if only they were treated X way or Y way by the regulators, then perhaps this wouldn't have happened. I think that's something that we'll have to see as we go forward.
It also doesn't help that this is the latest in a series of issues for Uber. Corey Dade works in crisis management with the PR firm Burson Marsteller.
There are issues around the CEO and other executives and how they've dealt with different controversies that come up. There has been criticism in the past over how the company has responded to safety concerns raised by women who've been riders in Uber vehicles. There have been concerns about how the company responds to news reports that Uber may think are unfavorable.
That matters because a company's reputation going into a crisis is very important for how easily the company can emerge from it, says Paul Argenti. He's a professor of corporate communication at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
Because when something bad happens, if there's anything that questions your reputation at all, you're going to get hit much harder. That's just a part of the way life is.
If customers like you, if they trust you, it's much easier to weather the storm. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, pretty much all sunshine and light. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You hear a lot about the colleges that are based in and around Silicon Valley and how they're responsible for a lot of the things that have happened in high tech the past couple of decades. You hear a lot less about the education that the children of people who live and work in Silicon Valley get. That's in part because it's really two stories. You work at Google or Facebook or almost anywhere else in high tech, you get a decent paycheck, and so you can afford to send your kids to innovative and expensive preschools. But a new study shows that right nearby are parents with far fewer choices when it comes to early education for their kids. From KPCC, Deepa Fernandez takes a look at the kindergarten divide.
To get a sense of what it's like to be a preschooler in Silicon Valley, I took a tour of two very different communities. I started in Palo Alto, home to some of the hottest new startups that are making, well, loads of money. Homes here sell for, on average, $2.5 million, and parents have lots of childcare choices.
We're going to take three nice deep breaths all together.
Like this preschool that starts the day with mindfulness. It's called the Alt School, and it dubs itself School Reimagined. There's savvy technology use, like this workout with a cool basketballer.
7, 8, 9.
Beam him in via laptop, internet, and a huge screen.
Stand with your feet about shoulder width apart like this.
And just like good startup culture, teacher Jen Aguilar models that it's okay to fail.
Oh, goodness. And Andy, oh, wow. I made two mistakes this morning. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, what should I do?
The startup culture and mentality is really about how do we give students autonomy and choice.
Chris Basilko is the head of school at Alt.
So they can see themselves as active agents, active doers in the process, not just consumers of education.
Innovation abounds. How about an app to keep parents updated? Cindy Jett Stolp has a preschooler at Alt.
On our smartphones, there's a little icon that's a parent portal. They would show us some of the things Mikey took pictures of and his observations.
This model impressed Mark Zuckerberg and other venture capitalists so much that they gave the school $100 million last year. Preschool tuition is about $27,000 a year. These, you might say, are the lucky kids, the four-year-old haves.
Our study looked at preschool participation in Silicon Valley.
And if you ask Gina Adams of the nonpartisan think tank, the Urban Institute, Silicon Valley is also home to the four-year-old have-nots.
And we found that even in a place of great wealth and innovation like Silicon Valley, you still find significant proportions of low-income kids who are not participating in preschool.
Betsy Nikolchev of the Family Engagement Institute at Foothill College is my guide to see the other side of the preschool divide.
As we head just across the 101 freeway, we enter East Palo Alto, and it's literally two different worlds.
As an early childhood expert, Nikolchev has spent a lot of time in preschools here. In East Palo Alto, there are about 3,000 kids under five, but only about 500 places available in licensed childcare. So while a lot of kids in East Palo Alto are probably being watched by a neighbour or parent, the lucky ones might get a seat here.
It is a child development centre.
We're outside a preschool where there's graffiti and the play equipment is old. There's little greenery. So how's the education here?
It's questionable about how ready the children are after experiencing that upon entering kindergarten.
And that's where I meet 4-year-old Jesus, who attends this preschool.
Yo quiero ser un helicóptero.
This aspiring helicopter pilot is lucky to have a seat here, his mother, Inez Alcala, tells me. His older sister missed out on preschool because there was just nothing available. This immigrant mother from Mexico has heard about the preschools across the freeway in Palo Alto.
But they're so far away, and I don't have a car. It would be too hard to walk there with my two small kids.
And there's also the cost. The Urban Institute report found many barriers, like transportation issues and even language barriers, hinder immigrant families from accessing quality childcare, says Gina Adams.
It's, for example, a number of programs are part day. If you're a full-time working parent, that can be hard.
There is some good news for little ones in East Palo Alto. Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan are funding a new school here, set to open in August. There'll be free infant and toddler care as well as preschool. And maybe some of the bells and whistles from the other side of the 101. In Silicon Valley, I'm Deepa Fernandez for Marketplace.
A detour for a moment into the foreign exchange markets now, where traders can make or lose bundles on even the slightest changes in currency values. The British pound lost 1.7%. In other words, the technical term here is a boatload against the dollar today, thanks in no small part to Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, saying he is going to campaign on the Leave side in the upcoming British referendum on whether or not that country should stay in the European Union, the Brexit in the vernacular. Seeing as how the EU is, as a bloc, this country's biggest trading partner, we've gotten Stephen Beard on the phone from London to talk things over. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
Help me understand, would you, why Boris Johnson, the mayor of the city, that's capital T, capital C, of course, the financial center of arguably that part of the world, why he wants to pull out of the EU?
Well, he says it's about sovereignty and democracy. He points out up to half the legislation currently being imposed on the UK now comes from the EU. European courts and the European Parliament have the power in many areas of activity to override the UK courts and the UK Parliament. So Boris and others who plan to vote out say, we've got to save British democracy.
And he's hoping, isn't he, Boris Johnson, to get, after the outvote, he wants to renegotiate the renegotiation or whatever the heck it is?
Yes, well, he doesn't believe that that will be the end of the story if the Brits do vote for Brexit. He thinks that Britain would be too big to leave festering on the sidelines, that there'll be some sort of deal negotiated.
Yeah. What do businesses over there say? Is it in or out, generally speaking?
Well, most of the city, London's financial centre, wants in.
Right.
Much of big business, most of the top 100 companies, those that are listed in the FTSE 100 index, want in. They fear that Britain will face tariff barriers and other obstacles to trade if they do pull out. And Europe is the UK's biggest single market. But there are a lot of dichotomy here because there are a lot of small to medium-sized companies, and these are the biggest employers overall in the country, who don't trade with the EU, and yet they have the cost and the burden of all the EU regulations and the red tape. So among these smaller companies, there's a lot of support for Brexit.
And then the public mood, you know, the actual people who will vote as opposed to the businesses, what's that like?
The polls are indicating a 50-50 split, right down the middle. Mm. The big issue for members of the public who are for out is immigration. Many of them fear that it's out of control and that by pulling out of the EU, they'll at least be able to stop EU citizens from flooding in. There's also concern about the $16 billion a year net that British taxpayers pour into the EU coffers. But on the other side of the argument, there is anxiety about pulling out. As David Cameron has said, it's a leap in the dark, and some in-campaigners claim 3 million EU-related jobs could be lost.
Remind me, Stephen, 23rd of June, right, is the vote on this thing?
That's right, yeah.
All right, Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
And we're pulling out any bugs, any leaves, any stems. So that's a real difference between inexpensive wine and more expensive wine.
Well, that's good to know, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 228 points today, 1.4%, ended things at 16,620. The NASDAQ gained 66 points, 1.4%. Finished at 45.70. The S&P 500 climbed 27 points. Also, hey, looky there, 1.4%. Closed at 19.45. Aerospace giants Honeywell International and United Technologies have been talking about a merger, according to reports today. Honeywell is said to be acquiring UTC for a combination of cash and stock. The merger could create a company with $90 billion worth of sales. Honeywell down 2% on the news. United Technologies up 4.7%. Bank of America rolled out a new mortgage product that will allow borrowers to make down payments of as little as 3%. Stop me if you've heard that one before. B of A shares up 3.4%. Lumber liquidators sank through the, through the floor Monday after the CDC said people exposed to certain types of the company's laminate flooring were 3 times more likely to get cancer than the agency had previously predicted. Yeah, you know what's coming up. Company shares down 20%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It took 100 years for modern science to prove Einstein's theory about gravitational waves was right. It also, not coincidentally, took $1.5 billion to do that. Lofty goal, lofty price tag, because high-powered science doesn't come cheap. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains how that science funding happens and how one might judge the return on those investments.
It turns out the way the U.S. invests in science is a big, puffy, diffuse process. And, it turns out, so are the economic returns. Science funding approval involves a lot of people.
When it comes to the really big asks, like LIGO and some of the big telescopes and ships and accelerators and so on.
LIGO was the gravitational waves experiment.
There, we are really looking to a bigger community to make those kinds of decisions.
France Cordova is head of the federally funded National Science Foundation, which spends $5 to $7 billion each year on science experiments. So how do they find out what the scientific community wants to spend the big bucks on? They ask.
Very large-scale surveys of science.
Michael Maloney is with the National Academies of Sciences. The NSF asks the academies to do what are called decadal studies, big studies about once every 10 years.
To look at what the scientific priorities are for the decade ahead.
And what telescopes or reactors or big projects would be needed to pursue those priorities and roughly how much they might cost. They set up committees and panels of scientists all over the country.
White papers at town hall meetings. It's usually a 2-year process of a lot of back and forth.
The rankings of projects that come out of this process are what the National Science Foundation or NASA or DOE go by. The NSF has become a target for some Republicans in Congress. The House just passed a bill requiring the agency to certify the usefulness of its grants. Bill Andreessen is Associate Vice President for Federal Relations at UPenn.
I think there's a misunderstanding between some members of Congress and the research community that, you know, every grant that's given out should have some economic, potential economic benefit, and that's just not the way science works.
Not only is some science valuable in non-economic ways, but when research does have an economic impact, you can't always know it ahead of time. Studies of eagles ended up leading to advances in contact lenses. Research on digital libraries helped lead to Google. And thousands of PhD students and postdocs who worked on NSF-funded projects are now all over Silicon Valley. Those scientists say they are the economic payoff of funding basic science. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There are things that happen in the land of business and the economy that are sometimes more confusing than clear. That is the motivation behind our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today's question comes to us courtesy of Michael Devitt. He's in Boise, Idaho.
How do wineries set the price for a bottle of wine? And what is the difference between, say, a $10 bottle and a $30 bottle? Is it costs? Is it taste?
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes it from there.
So the first thing you should know is there's a difference between wine that's mass-produced and sold nationally or internationally and wine from wineries that only sell locally. So now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's chat with Robert Ross Moody. He's chairman of the Sommelier Society of America. A sommelier being a wine expert, often at a restaurant. Moody is holding court at his favorite bistro in New York. He says 80% of the cost of a $30 bottle distributed nationally is advertising.
They've spent a lot of money to promote the particular wine, and the more money they spend promoting the wine doesn't necessarily mean that makes it a good wine.
Moody says most of the wine made today is just average, even below average, what he calls plonk.
All it has to do is be wet and have alcohol in it, and that's plonk.
But Moody says don't be suspicious of cheap wine. It could surprise you.
Never do that. That's a big boo-boo. Just because the wine costs $10 doesn't mean it's plonk.
Okay, so you know what plonk is. Now let's talk about those small local wineries I mentioned. This part of the story needed grueling in-person research. A winery visit was required. I trekked to a winery in my home state of Maryland. Knob Hall Winery is in the western part of the state. It's owned by Dick and Mary Beth Seibert. When I knock on the door of the farmhouse behind the winery, Dick answers, along with a golden retriever and a corgi.
You got the welcoming
crowd.
How are you?
I'm
fine. Yeah, let's go over there if it's not too cold.
We head across the farmyard to the winery, sit down, and I ask Dick Seibert how they price their wine. He says the price depends on three big costs.
It would be vineyard, then production, and then sales.
The vineyard costs $17,000 an acre just to get it up and running. That's the cost of plants, a tractor, a sprayer. The production costs? Expensive hand picking of the grapes, followed by hand sorting, which the mass producers don't do.
And we're pulling out any bugs, any leaves, any stems. So that's a real difference between inexpensive wine and more expensive wine.
Ew! So you might get bugs in cheap wine. I, for one, am willing to pay more for bugless wine. That last cost Seibert mentioned, sales, they've got one salesperson who goes around to restaurants, but they spend very little on marketing.
Not even 0.8% is marketing, no.
But the small wineries are all a little different. And that brings us back to the listener who asked about wine prices in the first place, Michael Devitt. He did some reporting of his own in Boise, where he's a physical therapist. Michael went to a winery just outside Boise called Coiled. Owner Leslie Preston gave him a tour.
Wow. This is Case Good Room.
They sit down to chat, and Michael pops the question.
So, Leslie, how do wineries set the price of a bottle of wine?
Preston answered by breaking down the cost of a bottle of her wine.
The grapes are going to be about 15%. The package might be 10%. The production is the vast majority of the cost for me.
So there's your answer from Boise. Now, if you don't have the stamina for a grueling winery visit, don't worry. Our sommelier, Robert Ross Moody, he says your best bet is to go to a wine store and ask, what's good? They'll steer you away from the plonk. Exhausted from this very tough assignment and ready for a drink, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Your questions, our answers. Hit us up with what you've always wondered. Marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which Bernie Sanders gets hoisted on his own rhetorical petard. Senator Sanders, as you may know, likes to say that Wall Street's business model is fraud. And in fact, today his campaign tweeted this, quote, "Greed, fraud, dishonesty, and arrogance, those are just some of the adjectives we use to describe Wall Street," end of quote. Problem is, Senator, those are all nouns, man. I'm not usually that much of a stickler. It just kind of got me that one day. All right, the Dow up 228 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 66 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 up 27 points, yes, 1.4%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bondner, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.